I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our Deputy Editor, Matt Maitham.
Hello.
And our Reviews Editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
Okay, so this week we're getting into an American pickle with Seth Rogen. We're assessing Annette Bening and Bill Nighy's Hope Gap. And we're popping to Algeria with Papicha. First up, though, shall we answer a reader's question? What film performance do you think deserves more recognition and praise than it gets? For Bob Stuttle, who wrote in with this, it's Caitlin Dever in Short Term 12. What about you guys? What do you think?
That's a great shout from Bob, because I do often think it is the more subtle performances that get overlooked in favour of actors who kind of do the most acting and, you know, have the kind of biggest transformations. There's a lot of subtle performances get overlooked. Like, historically, one that jumps out for me maybe is, I think Tom Cruise was overlooked in Rain Man because Dustin Hoffman had that much showier role. Yeah, I think Tom Cruise was really great in that. And I also think kind of really great all-in comedy performances are often a bit overlooked because they kind of can be a bit silly, obviously, and make us laugh. But something like Will Ferrell in Elf as Buddy, I think that is as much of a feat to make us believe in that character as some much more traditionally Oscar awards.
Was Ron Burgundy? Will Ferrell's Ron Burgundy as well. Was his Oscar nom for that?
Exactly, yeah.
What about you, Matthew?
This was one I found out recently and I was absolutely horrified by it. It's one of the all-time great award snubs. But Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, Cassandra Peterson, was nominated for a Golden Raspberry for this film, and she's magnificent in it. I mean, thankfully, she didn't win, but absolutely shocking miscarriage of justice because she's fantastic in it. It's one of the all-time great camp horror performances, if you ask me.
Well, yeah, and that's where sometimes camp and the Razzies intersect and actually knows exactly what they're doing and is deliberately doing something that other people determine is rubbish. For me, I'm going to say Matthew McFadden in just about everything. I think he's absolutely great in Pride and Prejudice, and I think he's better than Colin Firth in the TV show. I just think he brings a certain pained element to Mr. Darcy. But I just think he's been really good for ages. He's really good in this little film that came out years ago called In My Father's Den. He was great in Quiz as, you know, the coughing major. He's amazing in Succession. He is a guy that I think people don't realise how versatile and great he is. I just think he's overlooked in everything. So talking about performances that are overlooked, let's talk about performances that are actually finally getting some audiences to see them, with the news that Mulan is no longer just in a holding pattern waiting to come to cinemas. What's happening with it, Matt?
Well, from what we've heard, breaking just as we're recording this podcast is, it's had all these setbacks. Obviously, originally supposed to come out in cinemas in March, it's been pushed back and back, and now it's just been announced that on September the 4th it's going to premiere on Disney Plus for a premium fee of $29.99 in dollars. We're not 100% sure what's happening in the UK, or I'm not at least, because this report in Variety says that the film will be released theatrically in markets in which access to the movie on Disney Plus is not available. So I'm not sure what that means for the time being, because obviously we have Disney Plus in the UK, but the way it's phrased makes it sound like it might not be in all territories for whatever reason. So we don't know. But I would imagine that if it's going that way in the States, pretty much worldwide, wherever they can, it'll come out on Disney Plus. Yeah, so it was a big shock because they've kind of held it back for a while, seemingly hoping for a cinema release. Clearly a very big budget film. Looks very much like a big screen experience in terms of the sets, scale, all things like that. It's also surprising because as we discuss all things film in our WhatsApp group this morning, we were saying that this seems like the most expensive yet in terms of these straight to digital home releases, because you've got that basically $30 fee, but that's on top of your Disney Plus subscription. So obviously previously everything on Disney Plus, Hamilton,
Optimus Fowl,
you get that as part of your sort of subscription package that you're paying for. So to then ask for a whopping fee, which is more than Trolls World Tour and things like that have charged, that could be a prohibitive entry point. What do you think, Matthew?
Yeah, maybe for some, but I do think a lot of people will go for it as well, because it feels like it's the biggest film, you know, for such a long time. It's such a, I mean, it's a kind of a brand people are familiar with. It's been such a while since we've had a huge Disney blockbuster like that. I mean, it really kind of outranks things like Artemis Fowl and Troll World Tour. You know, it looks like a more enticing proposition So I think people will go for it.
It's got a built-in audience, hasn't it? Because people love Mulan and they love these live-action remakes that Disney has been trotting out every couple of years. So maybe this just speaks of their confidence in the product, that they're like, you're going to love it. You're going to think $30 is perfectly reasonable for your entire family to sit down and watch something where you'd be spending a good deal more than that if you took them all to the cinema.
You're spending on parking and concessions, aren't you?
And I mean, is this maybe Disney's leading the way on this? Maybe this is going to be the benchmark by which all other movies that end up going this route, which, let's face it, it's looking more and more likely that things are going to have to do this now. Maybe this is how much we should be expecting to be paying for premium VOD.
It will be a huge blow for exhibitors, though, won't it? Because next to Tenet, it was the big one to sort of draw families back to the cinema. Yeah. And with that kind of going, it makes you wonder what else is going to then follow its lead and disappear off the schedule.
Somehow can't imagine Christopher Nolan wanting to put Tenet on a streaming service, though.
I think we'll be waiting for the big screen, yeah.
Yeah, even if that takes a year, I think we're still going to get that on the big screen.
Yeah.
Okay, so speaking of films that are in the cinema, shall we have a look and see what we can look forward to this week?
Yes.
Okay, so first up, let's pop the lid on Seth Rogen's new one, which is this.
In old country of Shlopsk, I am ditch digger. As far as jobs in Shlopsk go, it's pretty good. We are the Greenbounds, and we have American dream. I find good job in Pickle Factory. Sarah, I make this vow. 100 years, our family will prosper. And then one day, everything changed.
It's been 100 years. The pickle brine preserved him perfectly.
Too old to do that. The world has changed. Everyone I know is gone.
We were able to track down a great grandson.
Greenbaum. This is nuts. Walk past the cafe,
but you don't... That was American Pickle. Do you want to set it up for us, Matt? What is the pickling business here? What's gone on?
So, if you haven't heard about this film, basically it's a dual role for Seth Rogen, and it begins in 1919, and we meet this guy called Herschel, who's a Jew living in a place called Shlupsk.
Basically, he's a ditch digger.
He's a ditch digger, yeah. A ditch digger who kind of can't catch a break and longs for, just sparkling waters, like the kind of, the ultimate luxury that he aspires to, like one day dreams he'll be able to afford a glass of seltzer water. And he meets a woman played by Sarah Snook of Succession and falls for her. And then they kind of have these really ambitious dreams and they immigrate to Brooklyn. From there, he gets a job killing rats in a pickling factory. And an accidental mishap sees him fall in a giant vat of pickles just before the factory is condemned and closed. And so I'm chuckling a bit at this.
You're making it sound a lot funnier than it is.
He's basically preserved for 100 years in pickle.
Then they get him out, and then who is he kind of left with to look after him but his great-grandson, who's also played by Seth Rogen, who's basically like a kind of hipster web designer called Ben, and he brings him into his little kind of fancy Brooklyn flat, and then it goes from there, really, a kind of this culture clash, fish out of water comedy. We're seeing what Herschel makes of sort of modern Brooklyn, in comparison to the aspirations he had as an immigrant, and goes down a couple of odd routes, perhaps, but that's where we're at. It feels like that kind of throwback to that sort of fish out of water comedy that we saw quite a lot previously.
Mm. Yeah, and the sort of Eddie Murphy style-y playing two characters who interact with each other. Is it successful, though? I mean, that log line of a guy is pickled, he wakes up 100 years later, this is something that we've seen numerous times, time travellers that end up...
Not in pickles, though.
No, I mean...
Not in brine.
Not in brine. And also, they make absolutely zero concession to explaining how that happened. It's just ridiculously under-explained, because it's just it really doesn't matter. It's just a method to get you to the situation of this man who used to living in sort of poverty in the early 20th century and is now in the 21st. Does it work?
Overall, for me, not really would be the answer I'd say to that. The thing that really kind of was like a penny drop moment for me was when the credits came up at the end, and it basically said that the writer, you know, is written by a guy called Simon Rich, who's like an American comedy writer, and it's based on a short story by him. And then it was like, I was like, oh, that makes so much sense, because it feels like it's a funny sketch that's been just dragged out. I mean, it's 88 minutes, I think. It's just comes in just
it
under
barely manages and that, does it?
The most damning thing I could say about it is I sort of looked at my watch when I was like an hour into the film, and I was like, oh God, like I've still got another half an hour left. Like, not that I was hating it, but I was like, I must be near the end of these 90 minutes, because
it's what just
I was
a bit saying, lightweight.
Yeah. And in its defense, I think Seth Rogen's good in it. And I do think he kind of does manage to differentiate these two characters. Because at first you're just seeing, oh, you know, so how do they do that? You know, I'm always quite mesmerized by how they manage to do that.
Yeah. Now it's a stand-in. Now it's Seth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now it's CGI.
Yeah. Who did they get?
And there's something initially, at least, anyway, there's something almost sort of sweet about Herschel, I found. So I thought he did quite a good job of like kind of being that character. But then it's just kind of not funny enough, and it kind of doesn't make strong enough points. Like, you know, I don't know, just what it says about the immigrant experience or the Jewish experience in modern America. I just didn't think it said enough.
I didn't know really what it was trying to say, because it was trying and reaching for all sorts of things, like the fact that he's a guy who says what he thinks in a sort of Trumpian way and becomes hugely famous. Like, are we doing a social commentary on the fact that we celebrate people that are cruel or whatever it is? There's the whole, like, what it means to have family. There's a sort of subtext about grief and what you do to impress your parents. As you say, there's the immigrant experience, there's the Jewish experience, there's
hipster culture.
There's a lot of taking the piss out of hipsters and their various milks that they have in their fridge. So it's just like it's trying to do all these things and not really sticking to any of them. And so it felt very much like, as you say, a sort of sketch. And I could have seen those sort of sketches running on a weekly TV show, where this week it's Herschel and the Pickle War, which is this whole thing where he decides he's going to make pickles with rainwater and forage cucumbers out of dirty jars, and hipster Brooklyn goes mad for it, which is in itself a little sketch about sort of how ridiculous we are as a culture, that we sort of, you know, really treasure artisan stuff when actually a lot of it might be crap. So I could see this working as a series, but as a whole, it doesn't for me. What about you, Matthew?
No. Yeah, no, I didn't think it hung together. It kind of reminded me like a Woody Allen film, like Zelig, but also of a Sacha Baron Cohen movie. I mean, particularly Borat. But it feel like it didn't really kind of marry up those two tones successfully. And I think the other big problem I had with it is there's just too much Seth Rogen in it, really. There aren't enough other characters that develop. It's all the time. It's him and his great-grandson. I mean, you have Sarah Snook, who's great, who's been brilliant in other things, but she makes a very brief appearance. And, well, no spoilers. But there aren't any other characters, really, who register. So it's all the time. It's those two. And I felt like it just got a bit airless, really. I wanted to see them interact with other people, and I felt it would have developed a bit more. And I just didn't really find it very funny either. I mean, sporadically, but not many big laughs apart from at the end. I thought they saved the best right for the very, very end, the end credit scene.
And again, without really going into it, I mean, not that you can really spoil it, but that just felt like it would have been a better format for the whole film, what you see in the end credits. Just see little bits of that. As like maybe like Jane was saying, a TV series, or even I thought like a web series where there's like you get like 5 minute bursts every now and then. I could see it working.
Maybe a Queeby thing.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And just pickles are funny. Pickles are inherently funny, but they didn't really make the most of it.
Are they funny?
Yeah, I think so.
Funny.
I find pickles funny,
find yourself opening the kitchen cupboard and laughing at a pickled onion.
A pickle. Yeah. I felt like they could have done more with that, really. You know, it's got this great concept, the way it starts off, the actual pickling in brine, which is a great quirky idea. And then kind of it doesn't really have anything that matches up to that afterwards. So, disappointing for me.
I couldn't get over the fact that Jane kind of touched on this earlier, that with the whole science aspect, like he falls in his pickles, and they actually, I thought that was quite funny. They make a joke out of it that his voiceover covers up when the scientists are explaining how he managed to survive.
Yeah.
You know, that was like that. Quite funnily done. But then it's like, surely this guy would be like the most famous person in the world. But he just shuffles back off to his grandson's apartment, and then he kind of finds fame as like an artisanal pickle seller. But it's like, wouldn't he just be the most famous and important person on the planet? Yeah. I mean, I know it's a silly concept, but that just didn't ring true at all, you know?
No.
Yeah, because they were asking us to believe in the fact that he would become this sort of internet sensation because of the pickles he's selling. But at the same time, asking us to ignore the fact that media interest would surely exist in him as soon as he was discovered in a vat in Brooklyn. Surely people would be like, what is the pickle man doing next? Oh, he's making pickles, I buy them. It was sort of disconnect, wasn't it? It wasn't thoroughly thought through. And you know that Ben is sort of this guy who's just laboring this app that he's been working on for 5 years and still hasn't sold. So I had to ask myself, what is he living on? How is he affording this delightful apartment? And yeah. This huge array of hipster clothes that he's trotting out, all manner of beanies and, you know, expensive sneakers and stuff. And the thing is with that, is if you're thinking those questions when you're watching it and you're asking those questions, then you're not really fully invested in it. And unfortunately, those are the sort of questions I was asking about it.
For readers who don't know, we have a column in the mag each month called Is It Bollocks? And this would suggest it'd be quite a good idea for that one about can you remain pickled for 100 years? I think we probably know answer to that one.
The answer would surely be no, because how would he be breathing in that brine? Regardless, let's say that if you swam around in brine, you'd be pickled for 100 years. Mm. But would you not need breathing apparatus? And what about food? How is he getting?
You don't need that when you're cryogenically frozen, though, do you? So,
So many questions.
Plus, the fact you would never get that smell out either, would you?
No.
He would just constantly smell of brine and sort of.
Wouldn't he be discoloured as well? Wouldn't he? Sort of green.
Like a gherkin. Yeah. So as you can tell, if we're discussing this sort of thing at length, then this hasn't really hit the mark, has it? So
not really, no.
Is it worth your masked up trip to the cinema?
If you're a huge, huge Seth Rogen super fan, yes. And a Pickles fan, get to the cinema, but otherwise no.
Yeah. I have to say when I watched it, I did want to just pick out a gherkin from a jar of pickle because people were slinging them around at every opportunity. So maybe take yourself a jar of delicious gherkins whilst you watch it. Okay. So we're sort of semi not really recommending this one. So American Pickle is out at cinemas on the 7th of August. Right, shall we have a look at what else we could have a little look at in the cinemas? Should we go from New York to the south of England with this?
Hello, stranger.
Hello, Mum.
I can't bear to think you're unhappy, Jamie.
I'm fine.
Fine isn't the same as happy. No, we're happy, aren't we, Edward?
Yes, we're fine. I'm going to leave. She'll be better off without me.
I don't want to be here when you do it.
You can't just walk away after 29 years. You have to try.
I have tried for 29 years.
No.
Okay, so that is Hope Gap. Matthew Leyland.
Hi.
Where is Hope Gap? Is it a gap in hope or is it a real place? Tell
us. It's a real place. It's a real place. It's on the Sussex coast. So, it refers to some cliffs on the Sussex coast, which you see throughout the film.
And who is going there?
Well, it's a three-hander, but it's mostly a two-hander. And it stars Annette Bening as Grace and Bill Nighy as Edward. And they've been married 29 years next week. They're kind of sort of shuffling along kind of in their long-term marriage. They bicker, they kind of pick at each other, but everything seems fairly stable. Then their son comes to visit, Josh O'Connor as Jamie, and then Edward drops a great big bombshell that changes the course of this marriage forever, basically. And the rest of the film deals with the fallout from that, about how the two parents cope with it. And also there's a lot of focus on how Jamie deals with it as well. This is long-term marriage story.
Yes.
But with Bill Nighy and Annette Bening instead of...
Yes, and without any trumpets.
Black Widow,
no trumpets
Kylo
being
Ren.
Bought by anyone. Yeah. Did you like it?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I mean, mostly for the performances. I mean, I don't know if I'd have a different experience if it was other actors. I love both Annette Bening and Bill Nighy, and I'm happy to watch them in absolutely anything. And I thought they were both really good, especially Annette Bening. I mean, it's kind of equal-handed to start with, but I would say it shifts more to her as the film goes on. And I thought she was terrific. Her accent is perhaps not the best. It's perhaps not the most convincing to English ears, but I think she overcomes that.
It's kind of quite precise and yet weirdly inauthentic.
Mm. Yeah, it's a little bit
a very strange combination. It's very clipped, and so she's doing all the right work with it, but it doesn't feel real. But your ear gets used to that after a while, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think so, yeah. I mean, they could have just made her American, really. There's no real reason for her to be English. She could have just stayed American. I don't think anyone would have really minded.
you just know her as American so well. So even when she's doing like a decent job, it's, you're still questioning it in your mind, aren't you?
Yeah, I don't know that I loved this that much, I have to say. Mm. It's an adaptation of a stage play, and I think you can feel that absolutely. It feels very much like you would watch it on stage. Very sort of, I mean, people talk to themselves a lot in it and whisper things to themselves and talk in complete literate sentences that I don't think people really do. I certainly don't. Mm. And it also reminded me a little bit of sort of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and other sort of plays like that, that take this sort of marriage and have an implosion in it and the sort of fallout from that. I found it really difficult to care about either party. There wasn't enough to really grab hold on in terms of, they really didn't feel like they should have been married, and also didn't really care for the happiness of either one of them. Maybe I'm just in a bad mood when I watch this, but yeah, what did you think? And the other thing that really bugged me was the fact that at one point Bill Nighy bought a cornetto that was handed to him unsheathed.
Like I'm glad you know.
The seller had taken the wrapper off. And I was
what's
like,
that about?
Even before COVID, who'd be accepting that? You want to unwrap your own lolly, right? You're not, you don't want someone handing your cornetto in their naked hand. But also the pleasure of a cornetto is the unwrapping of it. And that sort of really took me out of it, because clearly that was a film choice, because it's like, we don't want to see Bill fiddling about with his cornetto and trying to put it in a bin and all this stuff. So just give it to him. But actually, all it did was make me think, why has he done that? Give me one wrapped, love. So
the thing that brought me back to earth in that moment, though, was I did like the fact he grumbled about it being £2, which, like, I mean, who doesn't buy an ice cream at the seaside? I'm like, what? Yeah. Like, when you hear the price, like, so that
but kind also, of
very contentious
that balanced it out.
Also, illogically, he says, well, you know, it's something about being at the sea that makes me want to buy one. It's like, you've lived your whole life by the sea. I don't know why you're suddenly like making a thing about being by the seaside when actually their house is on the cliffs. Sort of Seven Sisters, and they can see the sea with a quick walk to the edge of the cliff. It sort of, it felt very stagey, and it felt like if you read it as a book, you'd accept it a lot more, but on film, it felt really sort of inauthentic to me.
I was perhaps somewhere in between you two, whereas I definitely completely agree with what you just said, that I actually, again, I didn't know until afterwards it was based on a play, although for those, all those reasons you've said, including as well people just who can just recite poems off the top of their head, it does feel very sort of stagey and literary. And I really felt like I was wondering when watching it, has it been adapted from a book, because it just had that feel to it, the way the characters were speaking and the way it was kind of small and intimate. I sort of enjoyed watching it for the time it was on, like as Matthew was saying, largely led by the performances. I thought Annette Bening was great, obviously, and I actually thought Bill Nighy was really great in a kind of straight dramatic role, which we don't actually see him in loads, and he kind of
and very understated.
Very understated. I did like the fact there was this ambiguity, so it wasn't just, he wasn't just the villain who wanting to end his marriage. But then, as you said, I kind of towards the end, I didn't strongly care for either of them that much. And maybe this is just me being too harsh, but I found Grace, the Annette Bening character, just a bit irritating by the end, and almost like wanted her to, like, you know, get on with it a bit, really. But I did like that it walked that ambiguous line, and some great scenery. So I felt that kind of, the performances and the scenery helped make it feel like it wasn't just a, you know, this should be just a TV drama. I could have imagined seeing it in the cinema.
Yeah, I mean, those soaring sort of beautiful shots of the cliffs and the beaches look beautiful. And I, for one, would like to go and buy a cornetto down at Seaford, which is where it looks delightful. I might look at the trains for this weekend. But yeah, would I have wanted to have paid to see that? Mm. On the other hand, I suppose this is another one of these films that is for an old audience that are, you know, growing stronger and stronger as cinematic audiences grow. So, you know, perhaps this just isn't aimed at me. And if you're in the age bracket of these characters, you'd find a great deal more to enjoy in it, maybe.
What did you think of Josh O'Connor? I felt he was a bit surplus at times, really, because there's a lot of focus on how he feels about everything. And I don't know, I felt maybe they should have stuck to the two-hander. Not that he was bad, but I kind of wanted to get back to the other two whenever it went off and, you know, focused on him and his mates.
His mates were really irritating, weren't they? They were like, oh, are your parents getting a divorce? Have a donut, that'll fix it. No, it won't.
Yeah.
He's upset.
I think they were the worst written characters.
Were terribly written. The thing I liked about Josh was that I totally did believe he was Bill Nighy's son. They moved similarly. They sort of talked similarly. I think they'd done a really good job in mirroring each other. So I really believed in that relationship.
He's the best Bill Nighy son since Donald Gleason in About Time, I think. I think he ranks just behind him.
Fighting talk, isn't it?
Yeah. There's also a weird connection between this and American Pickle in that it features like web designer characters and making these kind of websites. And that, again, to me, is just always something that just takes me out of a film slightly, because I'm like, if it was really a great idea for a web startup, you wouldn't have made a film. You'd have made the web startup instead and made all the money from that. So you clearly have to choose an idea that would never quite work in real life. And that just always, again, just takes me out of the moment, really.
Yeah, that was a bit contrived. I didn't really like all that stuff about the website. It kind of tied it together a bit too neatly as well. Yeah.
And also you're thinking, how is this commercial? How are you making any money out of this?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, sorry, but what? Yeah. I liked Le Weekend a good deal better than this, if we're talking about sort of marriages of over 2 decades breaking down. I thought they did a better job with it.
Yeah. 45 years as well feels much weightier.
Yeah, it feels like there's other films out there that do this more sympathetically and empathetically, perhaps, than this one. It feels quite cold to me.
William Nicholson, the director, wrote Gladiator, didn't he? He wrote Gladiator and Les Mis.
Yeah, he's a great writer, and this is beautifully done, but I sort of couldn't really connect to it.
Would you have liked it on stage, say if it had been the same actors, same premise on stage? Do you think you would have liked it more?
I think I might have done. I don't know why. Just felt like that's where it belonged. Yeah. Okay, so Hope Gap is actually out this Friday as a one-off special, a special preview in cinemas. And then it's in cinemas and on Curzon Home Cinema from the 28th of August. So actually, you can either go and watch it now, or you can wait and watch it in cinemas, or watch it at home on Curzon Home Cinema. So it's good for everything. So take a look and see if you're offended by an unwrapped Cornetto as it offended us. Okay, so shall we move on from the UK? Let's go to Algeria. So that was Pepecha, which is a film from Algeria. Matthew, what is it about?
Well, Pepecha, it's like a nickname. I think it means young girl, and it principally applies to the main character, Nejima, who's played by Lina Khaldry. And this is a film set in the 90s Algerian civil war. And Nejima is a university fashion student. She's building up to running this big fashion show, but there's a lot of kind of discord and tumult all around them. There's lots of police checkpoints all over the place. So when she goes out with her friends, when she goes out dancing, they've got to be very careful. There's a lot of fundamentalism on the rise as well, which plays an increasingly important part in the film. So it's essentially about her and her group of friends kind of trying to lead relatively normal lives and fulfill their aspirations, but with all these kind of pressures from all sides. There's quite a lot of sexism that's imposed on her as well. There's lots of men around telling her what she should and shouldn't be doing and shouldn't be wearing. And then things do get a lot more serious and harrowing as the film goes on. As a main character, she's very believable and likable, and she gives a very charismatic performance. And in fact, the film won 2 French Oscars, the Césars, for the best first feature. And she won Most Promising Actress, and she'll soon be seen in Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch.
Yes.
So it's very much a very strong calling card for her, a kind of a breakout performance.
Yeah, this is something you want to see to get in on this girl and her career, because it looks like she's going places. Matt, did you like it?
I actually did really like this as well, yeah. I liked that kind of contrast you get between the vitality of these young girls and everything that's going on around them. I'm sort of a sucker for any film that gives you that window into another culture. And it doesn't really sort of hit you over the head with it, but you just kind of like, you know, you're sort of drawn into these young girls' lives, and they're very sort of likable. And then this stuff kind of happens in the background sort of, and gets, as Matthew's saying, kind of increasingly more sort of oppressive as it goes on. But there's something I found very, very engaging about that and the way it was done that, I was really kind of hooked into it.
I mean, it's got this very kind of intense political context, but it's very much a personal film at the same time. Mm. You're very much invested in the characters, and they spend a lot of time building those up. That does get you a lot more involved in the drama. You know,
does it give you an understanding of the sort of Taliban regimes that became stronger and stronger in this period of time, and how that sort of incrementally became more and more oppressive in various parts of the world? Does it give you that sort of sense, and how it impacted people's lives?
Yeah, in a kind of a day-to-day way, yeah. It doesn't sort of give you a huge amount of context. I mean, there's no sort of great preamble or, you know, captions or anything like that, which I think in a way is a kind of a good thing, because it does lead you more into the drama and get you relating to these people and seeing things from their perspective. It's a bit different from, say, like some of Ken Loach's films, which are a bit more didactic in that way. I mean, it's sort of a film you want to go and read up on afterwards. You know, if you don't know much about the Algerian Civil War, then I think you'll be inclined to read up about it afterwards. But for the most part, you are focused on these characters.
You do see, like, throughout the film, like, there's people, like, putting posters up and stuff, and they say things on them, like, take care of your image or we will, about, like, kind of, you know, encouraging women to cover up and things like that. So you see this kind of stuff happening. But, yeah, like Matthew was saying, it's not kind of right there in the forefront in a kind of, way that a lot of these films do, where it's, you know, completely explaining everything that's happening. Like, for someone like me, especially, who really wasn't kind of well read up on the Algerian Civil War, it's definitely more of a sort of personal, like, human-led side of it rather than a sort of political story. But you do come away thinking, wow, yeah, I definitely need to know a bit more about that and do some reading.
It's very kinetic. Yeah, it's really sort of fast camera moves, fast editing, which kind of helps you kind of immerse yourself in this world. You know, it's great to look at, but it's not kind of prettified or picturesque in that kind of way. It's not sort of one of a travelogue movie. You know, it's very much from the character's point of view. That helps make it more immersive.
If you could sort of liken it to other films that have come before, what is this film sort of like?
That's hard to say, really. I mean, I guess in terms of Algerian history, the key movie is The Battle of Algiers from the 60s, but it's not so much like that. I mean, that was very much styled as a docudrama, whereas this is much more of a personal story. And the fashion angle gives it a different flavour as well.
In that sense, it reminded me a bit of Rocks. I know that hasn't come out yet in the UK, but where you've got this, like, really, really vibrant sort of young friendship group, and you're sort of seeing the world through their perspective, basically. And obviously they face their own pressures and problems in Rocks, but not in quite the same way, obviously. But there was something about that, and maybe, just almost something of girlhood in the sense of that kind of vibrant female friendships again, although it's very different in terms of content. That's the kind of thing that it sort of brought to mind for me, which in a way was a good thing, again, because I find, as Matthew's saying, it's just much more easier to get drawn in with the characters rather than sort of pure history lessons.
So you can see Papicha on all digital platforms from the 7th of August. Okay, so this week you have American Pickle, Hope Gap and Papicha to watch in cinemas and on digital platforms. So now it's time, I think, for one of Matthew Leyland's fiendish quizzes. What's it on this week, Matthew?
Well, in honour of Seth Rogen's dual performance in American Pickle, this is the multiple choice, multiple role quiz.
Let's go for it.
Okay, who wants to be my first victim?
I will.
Okay, so question one. In which of the Austin Powers movies does Mike Myers play the most roles? Is it A, International Man of Mystery, B, The Spy Who Shagged Me, or C, Goldmember?
This is going to have to be a complete stab in the dark, because he plays loads in all of them, doesn't he? I'm trying to think.
Maybe.
Does he have that Scottish bloke in one of them that's an extra one? I mean, he obviously plays... He plays Dr. Evil. He plays Austin Powers.
Correct.
In the first two, certainly. Let's just go Goldmember.
You're correct.
Yay! Yeah.
He plays four characters in Goldmember. He plays Austin, Dr. Evil, Fat Bastard, who debuted in Spy Shagged Me, and Goldmember.
Is that a Scottish guy, the Fat Bastard one?
Fat Bastard is, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. Good, okay.
1 point to Jane. Okay. Matt, number two. What's the name of the McFly daughter that Michael J. Fox plays in Back to the Future Part 2? Is it A, Martha, B, Marcy, or C, Marlene?
Yeah, back onto guest territory for me for this one. Because it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I'm going to say Martha.
It's not the right answer, I'm afraid. Yeah. Marlene.
God damn it.
He does have a great wig in that, doesn't he? Yeah, he actually makes a good girl. I think he looks quite attractive.
Yeah, he's very believable. Right, number three, Jane.
Yes.
In which of the following films does Jean-Claude Van Damme not play a dual role? So is it A, Double Impact, B, Double Team, or C, Maximum Risk?
Oh, Jean-Claude Van Damme is not my specialist subject unless it's Hard Target, in which case, yeah.
Yeah.
Double Impact sounds like it's two. Double Team, is that even a real film? But it sounds like it's
genuine
two.
Genuine film.
I'm going to go for Maximum Risk because the other two have double in the title.
Well, you'd think that, wouldn't you? But it's actually Double Team.
Damn it.
He goes solo.
Yep. Is that the one where he's with Dennis Rodman?
That's right, yes. Oh,
yeah, I got the wrong question.
Yeah. Oh, no. Sorry, Matt.
Got the wrong question.
All right. Well, this is your question now. Which of these actors won an Oscar for playing a dual role? Was it A, Lee Marvin, B, Charlie Chaplin, or C, Donald Sutherland?
God.
Marvin, Chaplin, or Sutherland.
These are fiendishly difficult, Matthew.
Why is it called the Fiendish Queen?
Trying to think what could have been what. Charlie Chaplin seems like the most obvious contender to me, but I don't know if that's a fiendish trick of the question.
Well, I'll give you a clue. They've all played dual roles in film. That helps.
That's totally unhelpful, as usual.
That is the most unhelpful thing I could have said.
Right, I'm gonna guess Marvin.
You're right.
What was the film? I don't even know the film.
Cat Ballou. It's sort of spoof western with Jane Fonda.
Right, luck was on my side.
All right, now Jane.
Yes.
Lindsay Lohan played twins, of course, in The Parent Trap. But in which other film did she double up? Was it A, I Know Who Killed Me, B, Machete, or C, Scary Movie 5?
I know this because I love this film because it's so awful. I Know Who Killed Me.
Yes, of course it is.
Yeah, with the pole dance. That film's terrible. I love it.
Mm. Talking about underrated performances, I mean, that's probably not one of them.
No, that isn't. Okay.
Yeah. Matt, number six. Which is the odd one out? Is it A, Ernie Klump, B, Ernie Klump Jr., or C, Lance Perkins?
So this must be an Eddie Murphy related question.
It may well be. I can't comment.
This is probably wrong, but I'll show you my working. But I remember in the Nutty Professor films, obviously he plays most of the Klump family, but I know there's a kid in it that wasn't Eddie Murphy, that was a genuine kid. So I'm going to guess that he's Ernie Klump Jr. and that's going to be my guess, and that he wasn't played by Eddie Murphy.
Not a good guess, Matt. It's a great guess. You got the right answer.
Ernie Klump Jr.
Yes, the other two were played by Eddie Murphy, including Lance Perkins, the fitness instructor. So that's a point to you. Number seven, Jane.
Yes.
In Monty Python and the Holy Grail, they all play multiple roles, but who plays the most roles? Is it A, Terry Jones, B, John Cleese, or C, Michael Palin?
John Cleese is Lancelot. I have no idea. I'm going to go John Cleese.
I'm afraid it's the wrong answer. It's Michael Palin.
How many?
Nine roles.
Nine.
Yeah. Okay.
Including the narrator. Enough. Okay. Right. Number eight, Matt. In Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, Mark Hamill plays two roles. You know one, but what is the other one? Is it A, Omar Trez, B, Bulio, or C, FN1977?
You better not get this wrong, Matt, because Matthew will...
Well, yeah. I didn't realise he had a dual role, didn't it? So this is news to
that's
me.
That's not a good start.
So one of them is the ghost of Luke Skywalker. That's one of the roles he plays. So then Omar Trez, Bulio, or... FN
1977.
I don't think I'd be surprised if he just played a stormtrooper voice. So I'm going to say it's got to be one of the others. So I'm going to say Omar Trez.
No, it's the wrong answer. It's Bulio. Bulio, the alien spy who loses his head. And Omar Trez is played by John Williams.
Mm. Well, we have learnt something here today, haven't we?
Yeah. Multiple things.
So can I just say, me and Jane are on 2 points each going into this final round.
I think this might this might be the worst quiz we've ever done.
This is neck and neck. Okay, so Jane, in The Wizard of Oz, Margaret Hamilton plays the Wicked Witch of the West and Miss Gulch's. What is Miss Gulch's first name? Is it A, Almira, B, Elvira, or C, Valeria?
How does anyone know that? No, she's just called Miss Gulch.
She's got a name, isn't she?
How do we know that, though? Is her name in the titles? Does anyone actually call her by her first name?
I don't know. I haven't seen it. It was years. But she does have a first name, apparently, and it's one of these.
Okay, guesswork then. Not Elvira, because that seems too witchy and on the nose. Valeria? Almira. Valeria.
I'm afraid it's Almira.
Nobody knows that. No one in the world knows that. Only Miss Gulch knows that.
Only Miss Gulch is the world
kept secret. So I'm hoping now that Matt's going to fail the next one.
Yes, because it's too all Matt. All on you.
To play for.
Go on.
All right. Here we go, Matt. Number 10. Final question. What are the names of the Winklevoss twins, or Winklevi, if you like, as played by Armie Hammer in The Social Network? Is it A, Cameron and Tyler, B, Josh and Joseph, or C, Rod and Todd?
Pretty sure it's Cameron and Tyler.
That's easy.
Are you sure, though? That your final answer?
I want
Are
to
you?
Complain.
How sure?
Pretty sure.
You gave me that final answer?
Final answer. Final answer.
Final answer. You're correct.
Yes. Right, I'm a sore loser. I don't think that the Wizard of Oz question and the Winklevoss were equally matched questions.
Oh, dear. I'm sorry, but...
As they say, it's only easy if you know it, isn't it?
So the final scores, 2 points to Jane and 3 points to Matt. So it was close. But in the end, Matt won it.
Yeah, baby! Yeah!
As we mentioned in that quiz, one of my favourite films is I Know Who Killed Me, and I'm actually talking about another terrible film on another podcast.
Is it really one of your favourite films?
It's not one of my favourites, but it's one of my favourite terrible films. So,
yeah, it's great.
So in that category, I'm also on the Movie Bunker this week discussing Waterworld. So do check that out if you want to listen to me waxing lyrical about Kevin Costner and his charisma and also his gills. What movies do you love that are terrible, Matt and Matthew?
My default one, which I've written about a couple of times, is Howard the Duck. The very first Marvel movie, in fact, from 1986, which was an absolute travesty. Did terribly at the box office. All sorts of talented people involved, like George Lucas and John Barry, even. But it sunk like a stone at the box office, but I love it. Why? Watched it recently. Probably because my love of the 80s. It's one of the most 80s movies. I mean, it's kind of up there with Top Gun and Fatal Attraction in terms of its...
Oh, come on, it's up there with Top Gun.
In terms of its 80s-ness. No, not in terms of action scenes. But there are some genuinely good aspects to it. There's some good special effects. Leah Thompson's very believable as a woman falling in love with an alien duck. Yeah. Songs are good. Tim Robbins is quite fun. It's just an enjoyable movie, I think. And the duck puns are off the chart. I mean, they just keep hammering away at the duck puns, until they become funny. So, yeah, that would be my pick.
What about you, Matt?
Okay, well, I was struggling to think of one, but just I cast my mind back to Jean-Claude Van Damme in that quiz round. And so I'd have to say Kickboxer, just because it's so ludicrous, but just so hilarious at the same time. And features one of the all-time best dance sequences as well, when Van Damme's drunk in the club. And this song comes on and he starts dancing with these two women. And it's just, I went through a phase of my life where I'd watch that clip just daily, just for sort of motivation.
I thought you were going to say for inspiration. And that's what you now do down the disco. If the disco is
to recreate it.
A couple of times, yeah.
In the comfort of your own home, I hope.
So I can't remember what the song is, but I went to a friend's wedding where you could you requested your own song with the invite, and that was the song I chose. I can't remember what it's called, like Feeling So Good Today or something. And, so that was...
I think, what it's called.
I busted some moves then.
Fine choice.
So let's just close the curtain on that image and say goodbye. But before we do, just a quick reminder, as always, that there is 10% off total film subscriptions if you use a code INSIDETF when you go to check out at www.myfavouritemagazines.co.uk. Okay, so on that note, let's disco our way out of this podcast and say goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye. Bye.